Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to UFO Think Tank with your host, Alejandro Rojas.
Right. Welcome, everyone. I had to race in from work and get everything rolling. If you tried to join the chat, just got it up. For some reason, it was having problems and it wasn't coming up, but now it is up. And it is advantageous. We're doing a special Thursday evening show to accommodate our wonderful guest this evening, who is well worth accommodating, making accommodations for. And actually, this works really well because we have a cattle mutilation here in Colorado that we're going to be able to go investigate. So that's what I'm going to be doing all day Saturday. So this works out perfectly. Now I have my Saturday open, and you guys can spend your Saturday listening to the show if you weren't able to make it today on Thursday. Who is so special that we would change the time for? It is Mr. Clifford Stone. If you have much knowledge about the Disclosure Project, the project Stephen Greer put together where he had a lot of witnesses talking about their official, being able to see official secrecy around the UFO subject in their business capacities or in the military, in a bunch of very interesting ways. And of course, Clifford Stone, if you're aware, was in the Army. And while in the Army, says he was part of a group where they retrieved crashed UFOs. And actually, this unit I know had a special name, and I don't know if it was exactly part of the Army or not, but those are some of the details that we're going to get to and some of the questions that we'll be able to ask Clifford. You know, I know a lot of people who know him, and to know him is to love him, it seems, because people speak very highly about what a great and nice guy he is. And if you see on the blog talk, there is a link to his book because he has put together, he's done a lot of work with the Freedom of Information Act, putting together documents that he has been able to get released on this subject. And now it's hard to get. In fact, if you follow that link from Blog Talk to Amazon, I think you could, the cheapest you could get it for is something like $80. But it's a compilation of these files. So very exciting show. As usual, let me get through some of the UFO news so we can get to Clifford. I think he looks like he is on the line. But we talk about always the UFO examiner, Roger Marsh. He's always got a lot of great stories. Some of the stories he's got up, a Navy officer who had a UFO close encounter, which is great story. He gets most of this stuff actually from the MUFON database. And remember, you can go to MUFON.com and you can look at the CMS and you can look at these files, including all of the pictures that have been included with the files. So be sure to go do that. Also, he's written about shape-shifting UFOs over Pennsylvania. And you can get to him at examiner.com or if you look at UFO Examiner. In fact, if you go to examiner.com, you're probably going to see some local examiners because they get locals to write about local issues. And if you don't have a local UFO examiner, become that UFO examiner. You can email them and say, hey, you know, I'm into UFOs and I want to be our local UFO examiner. Then feel free to go to UFO Think Tank and look at the stories I post, and all of these stories that I'm referring to I do post, and then you can become the UFO examiner. We're more than happy to share the information. Uh-oh. Back there you hear my Chihuahua dog, and she's my co-host, and she protects us from the men in black should they be creeping up on our back. Also from people walking their dogs in highly mysterious ways. All right, some other stories going on. Portugal UFO. If you go to All News Web, and like I said, you can get these stories at UFO Think Tank. I haven't posted this one yet, but I will soon. In Portugal, there's a UFO, and there's a picture. There are a lot of people that saw this UFO, and the picture is actually very interesting. So it's kind of neat. You know, last month I brought you some pictures of from other countries, and they have a lot of sightings all over the place. And then one more interesting story. Don't have as many since we didn't have as much time, but Witch Mountain is coming out. The Race to Witch Mountain this weekend. It looks to be a fun movie, a Disney movie, actually in the Laughlin UFO Congress convention that they have in Nevada, Laughlin, Nevada. That just happened a couple weeks ago. They got to have a sneak peek, and everybody seemed to really like it. And in fact, it looks like they included MUFON to our surprise. I don't know if anybody from MUFON is aware of that, but from what I hear from even some coworkers is that the director in the Sci-Fi magazine is wearing a MUFON hat, and he kind of put some in a scene where they're in a sci-fi convention. He had some MUFON people at a table, so that's kind of neat. I'll have to take a look at that. And it's kind of interesting because next month, actually, I'm going to be going to our local sci-fi gathering, the Starfest, and I usually do a talk, and we have a MUFON table. My cousin, who runs a paranormal group for the Metro State College of Denver, is going to be there, and they're going to do a presentation. And it's really interesting. We find, of course, lots of interest. It's funny because X-Files featured MUFON, and they're like, wow, you guys are real, not just from the X-Files. And I would say 50% of the people who came to our table related mostly their own UFO sighting, if not a sighting from a family member. And that, I thought, was incredible because, of course, 50% of the people coming to the table, that's a lot, obviously. And we talk to a lot of people. In fact, typically we get 40 or 50 people to sign up for our email list. So it's the event that... I think, of course, you know, those people, probably a lot of you are very into sci-fi, that they look forward to this future where we're actually able to intermingle with people from other planets. And that is a great segue into getting to Clifford Stone, because Mr. Stone apparently has intermingled with people from other planets. And are you on the line there?
Yes, sir, I am.
Okay, wonderful. Well, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much for joining me here today.
Thank you,
got a lot, some mutual friends, and everybody speaks very highly of you. But I guess I wanted to start off with your involvement in the Army. So when did you join the Army?
Back in 1968.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, and it wasn't easy getting in. When I first tried to get in, I actually wanted to go in the Air Force, but decided to go into the Army. So I went to Fort Hays there in Columbus, Ohio, and they rejected me for military service, making me 4F, which means permanently medically rejected for service. At that time, they had the draft going on, so every 6 months you went back for reexamination. They'd send you a letter and say, greetings and salutations, you're to report to such and such Armed Forces entrance examination. In this case, I was back in Portsmouth, Ohio at that time, and they sent me to Ashland, Kentucky. When I got there, there was a visiting colonel who was visiting the site, who was a doctor, who told the captain that was going over the physicals to go take the rest of the afternoon off, take his family, go to Camden Park, which was a little amusement park there in Huntington, West Virginia. So he called me in, and he told me, do you really want to go in? And I said, if I had a way to get in, yes, sir, I would. At that time, you know, I was very patriotic. I was, like to think I still am.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt that my country could do nothing wrong. Vietnam was at the height of the war at that time. And I really wanted to go and serve my country. I mean, I felt guilty believing in the cause and not being able to get in, while so many others who didn't believe went and paid the ultimate price. Anyhow, he told me if I really wanted to get in, he'd fix it. And he says, then all you have to do is just let them know of your medical problem and you'll be out. And I said, you get me in, I won't get out. Thus began a very strange segment of my life.
And so everything was pretty conventional at this point. You started off joining the Army. How did it come to be going from the Army to this super secret group?
Well, it was like somebody already knew of me. Well, let me premise that.
Okay.
People who they use as interfacers, those who actually communicate with the entities, they don't have a school for that. They
mm-hmm.
have to find the people off the street. And a lot of times they know about these people for a long time, such was my case. But when I got in, there was nothing connected to UFOs. It started off subtly. Once I got in, I went through basic and didn't have any problem there. My mama didn't raise any fools, as I said, so I separated UFOs completely from the military. Anyhow, when I got to AIT, which is Advanced Individual Training, there at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, they had a visiting officer from the Pentagon Intelligence, and I was put on a cleanup detail to go clean up the post intelligence office, and I met this individual there, and he didn't act like he knew me or anything, but you know, we talked, and he took me over and started showing me some documents, pictures, and I'm looking at those and I'm thinking I shouldn't be looking at these. And I eventually told him, I said, you know, I feel uncomfortable looking at this information. It was all on UFOs.
Hmm.
Of course, it was top secret. Then there was a word, sometimes two or three words, following the word top secret. At the time, I knew what top secret meant. I knew you had to have a clearance to even look at that stuff, and I didn't have. But I didn't know what the other words meant until later on. Later on, I can tell you, it's caveats for the Sensitive Compartmented Information Program. When information
mm-hmm.
is so sensitive that having a top secret clearance don't get you to look at that type of material.
And what year was this where he was showing you these documents?
This was in 1968.
Mm-hmm. So very early on, even during the Condon Committee.
Oh yes.
Mm-hmm. Were these Blue Book files, or were these files that the Army itself had retrieved?
Well, the Army had their own files. The CIC actually is the ones that had what happened here at Roswell. CIC stands for Counterintelligence Corps.
Okay.
When the Air Force in 1947, as a result of the National Security Act of 1947, became a separate entity in September 1947, people who was in the Army, CIC, actually became the Air Force's OSI. Now, one standalone attachment that I have yet to get any information on outside of a CIC document was known as Detachment 35. This was an OSI detachment that was CIC only, meaning they only did counterintelligence work. UFOs fell under CIC. This detachment wouldn't even receive the files that the Army had until sometime in 1952. The Roswell file at that time was turned over to this particular detachment. The Army early on had what was known as an interplanetary phenomena. It was actually called the Interplanetary Phenomena Research Unit. Nowadays, I think people are querying them about the Interplanetary Phenomena Unit, which the R really needs to be there. Anyhow, this was a specialized group that actually went ahead and did the investigation of those bona fide UFO cases, that they felt there was some meat to them, in which there could be some advanced technology gathered from the study of the reports and even the debris and crashes at times.
And what did the R stand for again? I'm sorry.
For research.
Okay. So, and isn't the CIC the group that turned into the CIA?
Well, no. It was an Army unit, and it was a standalone unit until 1972. In 1972, Congress had great fear of this particular unit. So by act of Congress, CIC was disbanded. Now, CIC work did not go away. It was incorporated as part of the overall intelligence community within, like, Army intelligence. They have CIC units. The U.S. Air Force still has CIC units, but they're not a standalone group. The reason Congress got concerned was that in 1972, it became apparent that CIC personnel was very effective, more so than even the FBI, in infiltrating various anti-war groups that were militant. And they could fit right in, because, of course, they were of the same age group and didn't stand out like a sore thumb with a suit and tie. They could mingle. As a matter of fact, we even used them in sensitive locations to go to bars and things of this sort to talk to people and make sure they wasn't talking out of school about classified information, say in a bar or something like that, because if you work with classified material, when you leave work, everything you have learned or know about that classified material stays there. You don't take it home with you.
So the IPRU, part of the CIC, is a group, or they sprung out of the CIC.
Correct.
And about what year was that?
Actually, it has its roots in 1943 in the Pacific Theater.
Oh, okay.
Under General Douglas MacArthur.
Mm-hmm. And was it formed specifically to recover craft at that time?
At that time, it was to gather information on the so-called Foo Fighters and other phenomena that was being reported by the Allies.
Gotcha. Okay.
MacArthur wanted to know what this was.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And MacArthur seemed to be a believer. He seemed to believe in this stuff.
He had no choice.
Yeah. So at that time, when was the first crash retrieval that you know of?
I can't say for sure whether it was a crash, but there was an event that occurred in the Pacific Theater in 1943, which immediately led the U.S. Army to believe that there was, in fact, something going on. MacArthur is the one that started the movement to try to find out what was going on with the Foo Fighters. He wanted to know.
Mm-hmm.
He had a special group put together, and that special group went to do some research. In 1943, an Air Force general came forward to tell him that UFOs were interplanetary, and we had observers of this international event taking place at that time we called the Second World War. And if, in fact, they proved to be hostile, we had a more serious problem even than the war.
Mm-hmm.
That turned out that they wasn't really hostile. They were curious.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe that it did involve a crash, though.
Mm-hmm. And do you know the nature of how that craft crashed?
I'm not sure what the nature of it was. I'm very limited in knowing a whole lot about that.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine at that time there probably was, like it seems in modern times, policies to shoot them down.
We no longer subscribe to that policy.
Really?
All the way into the '60s, we did.
Mm-hmm.
In 1952, because they were flying over Washington, D.C., an official order was issued to shoot down any UFO. I believe there is an incident in the British UFO files that have been released involving a U.S. Air Force officer that was involved in a scramble to intercept a UFO in 1956-57,
mm-hmm.
where he actually closed in on the UFO, got a lock on, and then was ordered to go ahead and fire his full salvo of missiles, which I think amounted to about 24. By virtue of it being over a public, or being over an area that had population below him, he was hesitant and asked for clarification and confirmation that the order was real. It came back that it was. When he got to where his weapons would fire automatically and fire the salvos, the UFO took off and just left him standing still. Therefore, the weapon system could not lock onto it to go ahead and automatically launch the missiles, which it would have done. The next day, he was visited by a person supposedly from London, but he felt it was somebody from the U.S. intelligence community who debriefed him on the event and told him never ever to talk about it. And I guess I can say his name because he has talked about his incident since the release of the British files, and I believe his name is Mel Torres.
Yeah, Milton Torres, yeah. I don't know if you're aware that the public education piece for MUFON, so I had received some calls from the press during that period of time, because that story got pretty big, and even Nick Pope, who actually I had on a couple weeks ago, was on Fox News and others talking about that story.
Well, the file's there. It's only about 4 or 5 pages in length.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a written rendition, and actually somebody tried to come in and say, well, they believed it was a psychological evaluation to try to determine if, in fact, the pilots would follow through and fire in order to do so. Now, I know they have what's called ORIs, which is Operational Readiness Inspection, for SAC back during the Cold War. And they
mm-hmm.
would go all the way through, and the people would not know whether this was a real thing or just, you know, a test.
Wow.
Where they would, the bombers would take off, the missile crews would go ahead, arm, get ready to fire their missiles. The bombers would head to their designated locations over enemy territory. Then, at some point, they would be given a coded message. They would decode that message. Once they decoded that message, the whole crew on the aircraft had to confirm that it was stating whether we're going to war or stand down. This was just a test. At which
mm-hmm.
time they would return to base. The missile crews had the same thing, but it was very intense and very scary because if you work with nuclear weapons, you know what they can do. And there aren't any winners in a nuclear war. That's why
mm-hmm.
they call it MAD, mutual assured destruction. You might kill us, but before we die, we're going to kill you.
Mm-hmm.
So that type of scenario is what kept the world out of World War III.
Mm-hmm.
However, I don't think they would do it with conventional weapons. I've never been in any type of situation where they even would attempt to do anything like that.
That reminds me, they... Right. No, go ahead, sorry.
No, I was just going to say that nuclear weapons are very devastating. And there's a psychological factor there. While there's a less degree of psychological factor on conventional weapons, they are also less destructive.
It kind of reminded me of the scene in one of my favorite movies, Dr. Strangelove, where, you know, they go through the whole process of when they get that decoded message and have to confirm it and everything.
Oh, yes, sir.
Yep. So the last we left your story, you were 1970. The gentleman was showing you some UFO material.
68.
Oh, 68. Okay, yeah. That was above top secret. And what happened from there? Was this a gentleman who then recruited you?
Well, no. He left, and it just gave me a whole lot of food for thought. When I got to my first duty station, which was at Fort Lee, Virginia, 36 Civil Affairs Company, part of the 96 Civil Affairs Group, I went, reported in to the orderly room, gave my records to the first sergeant, and since I was supposed to be a clerk typist, I was a lousy typist then, I still am. So I told him immediately, I said, well, Top, I think you should know I can't type. He looked up at me and looked back at my records. He checked my DD Form 4, which is the enlistment contract, took it into the company commander. The company commander came out with the first sergeant. I thought he was going to say, well, you went to school, why can't you type? But instead, he asked me if I was colorblind. And I said, I don't think so. When I took my test, I wasn't. And he said, oh, okay, you know the difference between blue and green? I said, yes, sir. I'm wearing Army green right now. And he said, okay, just wanted to check. I wouldn't understand what he was talking about until about 4 months later. Anyhow, the first sergeant went ahead, made some calls. Then he came in, he says, well, you know, we need a unit NBC NCO. And a communications NCO. And he says, what do you know about that? I says, only what I learned in basic. He says, okay, we're going to send you to school. So they sent me to Fort McCollum, Alabama. While I was at school there, I met another person who was in the Army, but he was in the Army Security Agency and worked for the National Security Agency. So we became real close friends. When I got ready to come back to my unit, my ticket was missing, and no one knew what happened to the ticket. So he told me, he says, look, I'm out of Fort Belvoir, Virginia. It's on the way. I drove down here. I said, you just go drive back with me. So we drove back to, from Fort McCollum, Alabama, back to Virginia. And in the process, we started to talk about UFOs. Mm. I found he had an interest more so than what I really wanted to let on, like I had an interest. But anyhow, he dropped me off at my barracks. I went in, and everything went pretty good at that time. Now, at that time, they would go ahead, if you were NBC qualified, each unit during the course of the month had to supply people who were NBC qualified to go to a what they call a staging area, stay there for 72 hours straight, you went nowhere, in the event that there was a nuclear incident or accident. So you were ready to move out, just like I always equated it, the fireman being ready to go to the next fire.
And so, what does the NBC stand for?
Nuclear, biological, and chemical warfare. I think they call it ABC.
Okay. Yeah.
But we would go there. Well, one day I was asked to take our OIC for the NBC unit to Fort Belvoir, Virginia. And we went to Fort Belvoir, Virginia. I drove. Now, didn't have much money in the Army. At that time, I made $73 a month. Hmm. So what I did, I took a sack lunch with me. When we got to Fort Belvoir, it was an old theater that they didn't use anymore where they were given the briefing. All the drivers, when it became lunchtime, they decided that they were going to go to the base exchange, to the little snack bar they had, and eat there. Me and this Air Force Airman First Class, we stayed there and he had a sack lunch also, so we decided that we'd go ahead and eat. Then we were wondering, well, it's a little cool out here, so wonder if they'd mind if we stood in the lobby. Well, we went in, we opened the door, went in, no problem. When we got in there, we noticed the stairs to the balcony, so we went up to the balcony. When we got up there, they had like this plexiglass where you could look down, but you couldn't see, or you couldn't hear what was being said down below in the auditorium. Anyhow, we sat down there and watched them down below, and we were carrying on casual conversation. They showed some film footage of things that we'd already seen, which was training film or training films for NBC. Then all of a sudden, another person got up and was giving a lecture on something. Now, that's where it got interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because now we started to see things that you'd call UFOs, cigar shape, dish shape, pill shape, tubular shape, also with the bodies, both living and dead. Well, we initially thought these were just trailers
wow.
from sci-fi movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I know a lot. I've seen a whole lot of sci-fi movies, but I haven't seen anything like we're seeing here. And the airman said, well, neither have I. Says, but, you know, that's what it's got to be. Then all of a sudden we found out we weren't alone in the room.
Uh-oh.
They immediately took us down and put us in this panel van and wasn't using kid gloves with us. They almost pushed us down the stairs, and, you know, we were wondering, we're in trouble because we were up there seeing them show these trailers for whatever reason, and what's the big deal? Anyhow, they told us to shut up. They'd do all the questioning. We'd just provide the answers. Well, they took us to this one-level building way out in the woods. And I spent 5 days there. The airmen spent 3 days. But we went through, for no other term I can say, is intensified debriefing as to what we saw. On the third day, the airman went ahead, and he stated, well, I didn't see anything. And that's all I have to say. So they asked him two or three more times, you were there, what did you see? Nothing, nothing, nothing. So there was this guy there were two guys that was doing the interrogation. But there was this guy that sat in the corner, and he had a clipboard, and he'd make notes. And he never, ever uttered a word. Then he looked up and nodded in the affirmative. And they took the airman out of the room, told him, says, okay, we're going to have you sign some papers. All it's doing is stating that the events that have happened here in the last several days never occurred. You were never here. You are not going to talk about anything that you saw while you were there in that balcony. And this is a non-event. So they took him out. I never saw him again. Seeing that that was the end of it for him, I tried the same thing. So I said I didn't see anything. And looked over, waited for the guy to nod in the affirmative, only he didn't do that with me. He nodded in the negative, so I spent two more days there. At
wow.
the end of it, I went, it was dark, it was on a Friday night. I went to my dorm, or to the barracks. They took me back there. Strange ride, because I couldn't see where I was going. I knew I was at Fort Belvoir, or at least that's where I suspected I was at when we were
mm-hmm.
going the interrogation, and I knew we were going back to Fort Lee.
Now,
but,
when you were there and you saw those videos, was it similar to what you saw in 1968 or even more?
Some of the things were similar.
And these beings, what did they look like?
Well, they had several types.
Mm-hmm.
They had one that looked very humanoid. They had one that looked kind of like a robot. And mm-hmm. I can't say for sure it was a robot. It could have been some type of suit they were wearing. You had a couple that were your typical grays. The one that stands out the most is the one that was a grayish tint, but a marshmallowy gray. Not gray, not white, but a mixture in between. It's hard to explain.
And that the beings in these videos, were they dead or alive?
Some were dead, some were alive. Some were still pictures on the film, and some were actual film footage.
Oh, wow. So could you see these beings walking around in the...
Oh, yeah. Well, the reason I said it stood out, it was fighting to try to break away. And don't want to go into too much on that, but suffice it that it was... That's why it stays in my mind a lot. That's the one that really stuck out.
Gotcha.
Anyhow, the next morning, Saturday, they told me that they wanted me to come to the first sergeant's room, which was where the CQ or charge of quarters was. And when I got down there, he came and said, "What's going on here? There's some people that want to talk to you." I said, "Oh, yeah?" Then I was told to go into the company commander's office, and I thought the company commander would be there. Anyhow, I went in. It was the same two guys that did the interrogation. Now, all of a sudden, they were there to investigate why I was AWOL for 5 days. And when they started to ask me, I remembered I wasn't supposed to say anything. So I kept stating I was doing my official duties. I was in the performance of my duties. I wasn't AWOL. And they kept, "Well, for 5 days you weren't here and no one knew who you were or knew where you were at." They had to have a staff car bring the OIC back and another driver go and retrieve the Jeep that you guys went up there in. So where were you? And I said, "I was in the performance of my duties. I am not supposed to discuss it." Even though I know that these were the two that knew what
happened. Had you the whole time. Yeah.
So after about a half hour of this, I went ahead and I said, "What's going on here? You guys know exactly what I was doing." And one guy became real violent. He even went ahead and pulled a pistol, put it to my head, and told the other guy, says, "I told you wouldn't be able to keep his mouth shut. What we should do is just go ahead in this nail." So that time I wasn't really for sure what I was going to do and what was really going on. The fear factor came into play big time. Then the guy who was sitting behind the desk says, "I don't think we have to be that drastic," and told the other guy to go to the snack bar, buy a couple of sandwiches and some coffee. And he says, "If I remember correctly, you take yours black, no sugar, no cream." And I said, "Yes, sir." So the other guy left, but when he was storming out, he says, "I still think we should just go ahead, have a little accident here, end of discussion." So he left, and the other guy went ahead and said, "He's always acting up that way, so don't let that bother you. But, you know, we know you have an interest in UFOs." And I said, "My God, is this what this is all about?" And the guy said, "This is exactly what this is all about." He says, "I'm not going to try to pull the con on you and tell you there's nothing on those films. You know better. But at the end of this year," which now it's 1969, "everything is going to come out and the people will know the truth as to what really is going on. We're going to break the whole story. We're not alone in the universe. They found us. They're here. There is communication on a limited scale. But we don't have communication with all of them that are coming here. However, we may have contact with some that we've never had contact before. That's where you come in. We know that you have certain special talents that not even you know you have." And I said, "Well, that'd be news to me." "I don't think it would be too much news. I think you've had a lot of strange things happen in your life." Well, it's like they knew my whole childhood.
Wow.
But went ahead. And he got me to agree to reenlist for 3 more years and to assist them whenever I was needed from time to time. And by the end of the year, everything would be coming out and the secret would be out in the open. There'd be no more secrecy on it.
Now, do you think he thought the Condon report would come out in a positive way, or
there's no way. There's no way he could have thought that. I think what it was, it was to just go ahead to get me to go along. Because I asked, well, you know, and if I don't reenlist and if I don't go along with this, he says, well, then we have to court-martial you. I said, why? Because you're going to say I was AWOL for those 5 days? Oh, no, 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 no. You wasted tens of thousands of dollars of U.S. taxpayers' money. Said, remember when you enlisted? I said, yes, I remember when I enlisted. Remember the oath you took? I said, yes, sir, I remember the oath I took. He said, you enlisted in the United States Air Force, not the United States Army. Now, if you do as we request, we'll do a little memo stating it was an error, end of discussion. If you don't do it, then we're going to court-martial you for a breach of contract, a federal contract at that, because you should not be here in the Army. You should have been in the Air Force. And he pulled out my DD Form 4. Now, remember I told you the captain asked if I was colorblind?
Right.
Air Force blue versus Army green.
Mm-hmm.
So my DD Form 4 did reflect that I enlisted 3 years in the United States Air Force. Well, 4 years was the minimum you could enlist for in the Air Force. So at that time, I thought I better go ahead and do as they ask. So I agreed. And he says, well, I want you to think about it. But Monday morning, we'll come and get you. We'll have your enlistment paperwork ready. And we'll go ahead, go to the re-enlistment office, get you signed up for another 3 years. I said, well, what's there to think about? He says, well, you think about whether you want to go ahead, enjoy the freedoms that you have just being a soldier in the military, versus being a prisoner, because at the same time we will have the charge sheets. One or the other will be signed Monday morning. Needless to say, I re-enlisted, but then it seemed like it was going to be pretty good because I even got to bring some stuff home to show some of the folks what I was doing, that, hey, you know, a low scale, I'm involved in this. Mm-hmm. Now, some of the people even talked to a guy out of Paris, Texas, about what I had been involved in, about what I showed them when I came back from base, or when I came back on my first leave. And I guess I can understand how they remembered what was there, because it's, even to this day, it's never been in a book. It's never come out. But that
what you had showed them?
Oh, yeah. I had permission to bring back some stuff and, you know, show them, let them
pictures?
Know.
Pictures?
Pictures, documents.
Oh, I see. Wow.
Now, as soon as I got back, they were retrieved from me. I wasn't to make any copies or anything.
Mm-hmm.
I even had a big photo album, which actually, the photo album, which is, it was blue and white, and on the front of it, it was called Blue Book. But I have all the Blue Book files on microfilm. And I can tell you right now that the pictures that are in the Blue Book files, these are not the pictures that was in that book.
Mm-hmm. The pictures you had were much more impressive, I'm sure.
Oh, yes, they were.
Mm-hmm. And did they... Did they include entities?
They included entities.
Yeah. Well, so this must have been really mind-blowing to you, obviously. Now, one question I have is, maybe they, even if they hadn't set you up, being a young, patriotic man interested in UFOs in the first place, I mean, if they would have come to you and said, we need this kind of help, would you have helped them anyway, you think?
At that time, probably, yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, they didn't have to go through this elaborate ruse.
No, all they'd have had to do was ask.
Yeah, so really interesting that they would do that. So what were you thinking at this time?
Well, up to that time, I felt good about it because now I was learning more about something mm-hmm. that's been with me from the time I was actually about 5 or 6.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't be until I was about 8 years old in 1957 that mm-hmm. I would go ahead and connect it to being UFOs when I saw my first UFO up close and personal in broad daylight.
1957 was what the first time you saw one up close and personal?
Mm-hmm.
And how close and personal was that?
Well, it was about 10:30 in the morning. I went to mm-hmm. my friend's house, Michael Hubanks, and I went through the alley and went to his backyard. Now, behind his house was this storage building about 4 or 5 stories tall. And while I was at his back door trying to call him to come out to play some ball, I heard this high-pitched whirring sound like a high-pitched generator. Then I looked around for what was causing the noise, and it sounded like it was coming above. I looked up just in time to see this white opaque disc sail over the storage building, come directly over my head, then right over his house. Now, I know that there were people, because this was right in the heart of town. It was right on 11th Street there in Portsmouth, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And I know a lot of people on the other side saw the same thing.
Wow.
But being a kid, I mean, I wanted to share this experience with the world because now I knew flying saucers were real.
Mm-hmm.
My mom and dad wanted me to downplay it. I didn't really want to downplay it because I felt I have to tell somebody that these things are real. I just saw one. Anyhow, no one would listen, and my mom and dad would want me to calm down about it. And, of course, you'd be made fun of when you said this, but here's the strange part. I realized all I had to do was keep my mouth shut and not even acknowledge I believed in any of this, and I would have no problems. On the other side of the coin, by acknowledging that I truly believe this and believe them to be real under intelligent control, it opened you up for ridicule.
Mm-hmm.
But even at that, and even knowing that, I could not bring myself to say it didn't happen to save me from ridicule.
Yeah.
And I even had some of my close friends said, well, why don't you just say nothing happened. We believe what you say, that it happened. But it'd be better for you. And I said, I don't know. I can't explain why. I just can't do that. To this day, I can't explain why. I've gotten out of the UFO field 2 or 3 times, not really wanting to put myself through some of the things I put myself through. But I told one reporter once, it's like something psychic. You can't get out of it. Something keeps, you're chosen for something. There's something going on, and you're a part of it. You don't know what, but you're a part of it.
Yeah, like Richter Dreyfuss in Close Encounters type of thing. Hello?
Yeah, I'm still here.
So, assuming you saw the Close Encounters movie.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so same kind of thing, and I think it's like that for a lot of people. I mean, I know I had that feeling once, and it was the Disclosure Project, and you being one of the people that I had seen on the Disclosure Project, of course, just blowing my mind that all of a sudden that's what got my compulsion going, where now I spend a lot of my free time in this field, even though, like you said, the ridicule factor, which still exists, and, you know, no wonder so many people keep silent.
Well, what I like about now, today,
mm-hmm.
versus 35, 40 years ago, I had nothing. I could show nothing. Today, I can even show where I can show where people say my experiences are all drummed up, all made up. I've got a 4-inch thick folder where the United States military when I refused to keep my mouth shut, refused to keep going after what I knew was the truth. They tried to court-martial me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, people don't realize that that really did happen. I have the documents to prove it.
Mm-hmm. So this is essentially you. So we got into the part where you became part of this unit, and we're almost getting to day one. You could tell this, you know, this is a story that could go, I'm sure, for hours. But once you tried to get out of this unit, they tried to court-martial you?
No, when I came to the conclusion we were hurting people by our silence, by not telling them the truth, and decided it was time to let people know they're not crazy. I know of cases where people have committed suicide because they couldn't deal with it. I know of cases where people have lost their jobs and their families all just because they had an encounter with something of high strangeness. And we had the answers, yet we were, it's a self-keeping secret.
Mm-hmm.
We knew, but yet we downplayed it. We knew, and we tried to state, well, you saw marsh gas, or you saw the planet Venus, or the moon under unusual conditions. Believe me, I know where I live, there's a lot of weather balloons that are released and a lot of scientific balloons that are released. And I bet you I have 200 or 300 times where I've been called and people reporting that they were spotting a UFO. I'd go to the scene where they were seeing it, and immediately I could pick up on it was a weather balloon. Show you how hard it is to have people believe that it's a weather balloon. I told some people, I was there at work, and all my kids, they were, where's Stoney, where's Stoney, where's Stoney? We're all seeing a UFO. Well, I went out, and I looked up into the sky, and immediately I knew what it was because I'd seen so many of them. But if it's the first time you've seen one, it does look strange.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him, don't worry, it's just a weather balloon. Well, the information person, public relations person for where I work, was called by Human Resources. The lady from Human Resources was seeing it. And she said, told him, says, yeah, says, try to get a hold of Stoney and ask him if he knows what it is. Well, before he got a hold of me, he called some of the news people around here. So we started to get calls in there, and we were telling them it was nothing more than a weather balloon. But I actually had to get my binoculars out and let the kids take a closer look at it to where they could see the shape of it and the instrument package hanging below before they would accept that that was really a weather balloon.
Yeah.
And when we got the calls from the media, they went ahead, well, it don't look like a weather balloon. I said, it looks exactly like a weather balloon.
Yeah.
But that's what it is.
Yeah, those so, sort of frenzies happen.
Well, they thought what it was.
Mm-hmm.
It was White Sands had released at about 5:45 that afternoon.
Yeah. Now, in these court-martial papers you're talking about, and someone had asked in the chat, they mention that you got court-martialed. Do they say court-martial?
No. It never went to the court-martial.
Or that
they
had tried.
Yeah, that they tried. First, they tried to force my retirement, which I was planning to retire anyhow, but I wanted it to be my call. I didn't want it to be that they were forcing me.
Right.
And I went ahead and fought back. Well, when I decided, well, no, I'm still going to fight this, even after I was exonerated because they didn't want to appeal the EER, even though a general officer wrote a letter explaining that it should be lifted because it wasn't a fair assessment of me.
Mm-hmm. What was the premise that they were using?
Oh, well, they mentioned the fact UFOs. The colonel that was there when I first got there, he was well aware of what was going on. He was well aware because he was told. the people that took over after him was very concerned because I was getting calls from congressmen. I was getting calls from DIA. I was getting calls from the Department of Defense. And they didn't like that idea. And they wanted to know what was going on. One person took me in, a lieutenant colonel, and he sat me down and said, okay, now you're going to tell me everything you know about UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
And this was after close of business. And I said, okay, sir, you mind if I smoke my cigar? He says, no, go ahead. So I lit up my cigar, and I told him, I said, do you want to call your wife? He says, why should I call my wife? Well, if you're waiting for me to tell you anything, sir, one, you don't have the need to know. Two, it's going to be a cold day in hell before I tell you anything. So he went ahead and says, look, I don't care what your involvement in UFOs is. I don't care if they have 100 in the Pentagon. He says, it's just that you can't be open about it. I says, well, you know, the Pentagon agrees with you. I can't be open, but I am going to be open. We're hurting too many people. He says, well, what difference does it make to you whether they have all this stuff and you know about it and you broadcasting it when you shouldn't be because you're under orders not to? And I said, one big factor, sir, you have the luxury of not knowing the truth. I do not share that same luxury.
Mm-hmm.
And that ended our conversation.
So they knew about the court-martial, and the court-martial you said had mentioned UFOs.
Mm. They couldn't get the court-martial going.
Mm-hmm. And what did it, what content?
They first tried to get me out on a mental discharge.
Okay.
Well, the psychologist that evaluated me went back to them and said, the next time you send to somebody saying they're crazy, make sure they're not more intelligent than you are. Now, that made me feel a little good. But they then went ahead saying that I was lying. Well, now there has to be a review by a the staff judge advocate. So they did a review, and they went back and they told the Army, unless you are prepared to come out and state that UFOs are a matter of national security and national concern, you don't want to court-martial this guy, because that is going to be the premise. If you court-martial this guy, you're going to have to come out and state, because he's going to be hitting up on what his involvement was. That's going to be his defense. And there's nothing you can do to stop that. This is going to break wide open in the media.
Mm-hmm.
But the only way you can court-martial him, you must go ahead and state that he is officially tied to a gag order. And they did. With the Inspector General's investigation, there were reporters trying to get information on what was going on with me. And the Department of the Army put a gag order out that no one would discuss what was going on with me.
Mm-hmm.
That if they discussed anything, they were divulging information, and an official investigation at that time was being considered as secret, and they were not to hit up on it. I found out even the President of the United States made an inquiry on my behalf.
And so in your document,
by the way.
Oh, had inquired about you?
Yes. I have
during
a
this court-martial period of time?
Yes.
And your court-martial state that's
okay,
why the...
there was no court-martial.
Okay, I'm sorry.
They
the court-martial case documents you're referring to?
Right. The effort that they were making to get me court-martialed.
And that effort, those papers reflected that they couldn't go forward because otherwise they would have had to have admitted that they were investigating the UFOs.
Yes.
Okay, gotcha. And so let's move back now to, you know, the first incident that they actually used your help that they needed. Back in, 69?
It was in 69.
Uh-huh. So when did they first come calling?
Well, I didn't even know it was going to be a UFO incident.
Mm-hmm.
We went to Indiantown Gap, Pennsylvania.
Gotcha.
And it was on what they call an FTX, which is a field training exercise. And we went set up in the field, and the scenario was that we went to war with one of the communist countries and took it over. Now we were setting up a military government to turn it over to the civilian authorities within the country and make it a sovereign state of its own. But in the middle of the night, we got word that one of our aircraft had gone down and that they had nuclear weapons on it. So it was going to be like a broken wagon exercise or broken arrow exercise. And we went ahead, got our convoy ready to move out to the location. Now, we were told that a unit was already there in place and set up the floodlights and everything over the crash area and quartered the area off, that we would be the Bravo team going in. So the Alpha team was already there. When we got there, and I don't want to go into too much detail on that because what people don't understand, when you tell this, you relive it. And there's things you don't want to relive.
Mm-hmm.
I hope you can understand what I'm trying to say there.
Yeah, I think I do.
This story's on the internet. I know in some of the interviews I have had. Anyhow, when we got there, essentially I was told to go take the ABD-27, which is a surface reading Geiger counter, walk towards the craft, and call back the readings. I was in a mop suit, had a protective mask on, and I was calling back the readings as I approached the craft. And the closer you got to it, the higher the readings went. Not to the point where I was in any real danger at that time. But as I approached the mound of earth where the craft impacted, I could see that the craft didn't look like any aircraft I'd ever seen before, except in photographs, and this was a hill-shaped UFO. As I got to the top of the berm of the earth that had been built up like a mound, because it went in at about a 30 to 45 degree angle into the earth, and I could now look down and see the craft, but as I got closer, I saw there was a canopy, and on each side of the craft, on each side of the canopy, there was like, and I have to say kidney shape because that's the best way I can put it, hatch. One of them was open, and this is where I really don't want to go into it too awful much. One of the entities was flying out, so I immediately started to cry for an officer. I thought I needed an officer there. And the guy that I'd always refer to as a colonel all of a sudden appeared. This was my first encounter with him. And he told me, it's okay, son, you just go ahead, tell us what you're seeing. And I told him that he wouldn't believe me, that I needed an officer up there. And he kept telling me, just tell us what you're seeing. So I told him, and I told him that there was a person hanging over the side, and he asked me if this human. I said, no, sir, at least not on this planet. And he went ahead and told me I could come back. So I started to come back, and as I started to come back, I noticed that now the radiation readings we were getting were now diminishing to almost no more than just background radiation, normal background radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not common. It's only common in one thing, and that is in positron drive. Because with positron drive, you have total annihilation, in which you may get a burst of high radiation within a half hour, you have none. And
now,
that's an antimatter drive unit.
What did the craft, what would the body of the craft look like, the material it was made out of?
It looked like high polished aluminum.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you it wasn't aluminum.
Yeah.
And let me tell you the one thing, the biggest mistake we make.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest mistake we make when we go ahead and look for at a crash site or where a UFO is set down or something, and the man on the street picks up strange items, and they're analyzed. And a good case happened in Argentina. There was this UFO that exploded. Some of the debris that they found on the ground was taken back to a private laboratory, and it was studied. And when it was studied, they found some of the material there was magnesium. Now, the magnesium, this is a 1957 case. The magnesium, you know, that's one of the elements here on Earth.
Right.
But the strange thing about this magnesium, which everybody overlooked and decided it was very earthly, was that the magnesium was in its most purest form, more than we can make it here on this planet, even today. It was almost 100% magnesium with no impurities.
Mm-hmm.
We can't do that, even today.
Right.
There are still going to be trace elements impure within the magnesium we get. And we cannot get all those trace elements out. Even to this day, we can't do that.
Yeah, there are other cases where, people are quick to blow off these materials because they're made up of things you can find on Earth, but just like you're saying, they're in configurations that are not common on this planet or to even processes that we use to create these metals.
That's my dog in the background, only it's not a little one, it's a big one.
Yeah, it sounds a lot bigger than my little chihuahua.
But
so,
yeah, that's something that has always fascinated and amazed me, how we could go ahead. And another thing is titanium. And I don't know how to explain this completely. The molecular structure is different because the titanium that we find within these craft, it's about 1/100th the weight of the titanium we have on Earth. But it's titanium. Now, you want me to explain that? I can't. I have no explanation for it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Fitz report in 1948, proved conclusively that even if you applied atomic power, which was the best thing we could dream up of at the time, there is no way that a interplanetary spacecraft coming from Mars or Venus could come here to the planet Earth. And particularly in the numbers that they were being reported.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Fitz report in 48 was based on the scientific technology they had then.
Right.
Now, we go forward to 1995. NASA calls for papers for advanced concepts. Think out of the box. Because if we're going to visit other solar systems outside of our own, the solid and liquid propellants that we use to put rockets into space isn't going to work. We're going to need something else. From 1995 to 2007, NASA had the Advanced Concepts Program. It went defunct in August of 2007 because they said that it would require a lot of money to try to go ahead and make practical applications of any of the papers of the advanced propulsion systems they were talking about, such as ion engines, antimatter drive, traversable wormholes, all these things which our visitors use to get from where they're coming from to here. Someday we are going to accomplish that. According to NASA, though, that is at least 1,400 years into our future.
Mm-hmm.
But the advanced technology we are getting bits and pieces of from our visitors I'll make a prediction, which I normally don't do. Within the next 100 years, we are going to achieve interstellar travel.
We're going to need to get a
technology combined with the borrowed technology we get from our visitors.
Yeah, we'll need to, we'll need that alone from them too, possibly.
Don't think so. We
yeah,
have prototypes right now we don't even talk about. And a good example of that, a good example, the Air Force did, the Air Force Scientific Advisory Board did Global Horizon, I think is what it was called, our New Horizon. They did this in 1997, I believe. It's a 14-volume document. We're going to get that, and we already have it in PDF, but we're going to try to get it out where people can have access to it. There's a classified volume, which they haven't released yet. Also, Air Force 2025. It shows all these marvelous new things that we want to achieve by 2025 and by 2047. The problem is we already have the technology to do what they are describing there.
Mm-hmm.
And remember the days of the mothership in which little UFOs would come out off of? And the Air Force Scientific Advisory Board, and also in 2025, both these reports describe motherships having smaller artificial intelligent craft that are launched from the motherships to attack targets. Should they come up on a target that they deem a higher priority, they can attack that target. They will have something like a 10-second delay before the operator says, no, the primary target has more priority than the target you're picking up on. Otherwise,
wow,
they will act on their own and attack that target, which they deem as being a higher priority. This isn't science fiction. This is science fact. This is things that we have heard of from the UFOs that people have reported before we had the technology to do it. Now we have the technology. We say we haven't done it. I would suggest to a degree we have done it. So
well,
the prototypes are there.
In the time that we have left, kind of to summarize your period of time, you know, in these crash retrievals, how many crashes then, we talked about your first, how many were you involved with?
I was involved with approximately 12 events. Not all were crashes.
Okay. Some of them were like landing.
UFO, it went down. Well, let me give you a classic example.
Okay.
And this is in the Blue Book file. In 1963, there at Edwards Air Force Base, a UFO seemed to be having mechanical problems. It set down on a dry lake bed. Immediately, SAT teams, sabotage alert teams, that's what it's, SAT stood for, was sent to the location where the UFO had set down. As they approached the UFO, another UFO appeared over top of the UFO that was on the ground, appearing as though it was trying to help it. The other the UFO that was still in flight started to lift off. At a very slower rate, the UFO was on the ground started to lift off, going back and forth like a leaf, only going up as opposed to coming down. They recovered debris there. Immediately, when they found there was debris there, all they could do was secure the area. A call went out to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base to advise them that they now had a moon dust report to file. The moon dust report was filed. Wright-Patterson notified a unit at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, telling them that they had a moon dust incident at Edwards Air Force Base on the dry lake bed. Immediately, the call went out for a blue fly op to start action immediately. So from Fort Belvoir, people left there. From Wright-Patterson, people left there. From several other bases in the United States who had special expertise in certain things, White Sands was one of them because they have the missile range there and they have missile experts there. They went there. So you had a scientific team that went there to a staging area, moved out onto the site to recover the exotic debris that was left behind. That's how a recovery is orchestrated in a thumbnail. There's a whole
that
lot
one
that
sounds,
goes on behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm. It sounds similar. Wasn't it Gordon Cooper sighting at Edwards Air Force Base where he had seen a craft land, they filmed it, and it flew off?
Yes, sir.
There yeah, astronaut.
Quite a few sightings that have taken... There have been quite a few events that took place there.
Well, and one of those events I wanted to ask you about, the Disney film that was sanctioned supposedly by the Air Force, or I believe it's Bob Emminger who talks about this, and you're part of that film.
Yes, sir.
You
I
know
am.
The witch. And in that film, there's a clip of film that people debate, and it does look like an actual real UFO video footage. Do you know if that's true? And I believe that was at Edwards Air Force Base.
The person did the book. I think it was called UFOs Here and Now.
Mm-hmm.
When he was writing the book, the United States Air Force Office of Special Investigations advised the person, Emin Ager or something like that was his name, that he would be provided not only with film footage, because there was going to be a follow-up movie on the book, but photographs involving a landing that took place there at Holloman Air Force Base. With the craft landing, a side of the craft opens up, and I think the story, there was actually five entities that got out, but I think the story goes there was three. One getting into a staff car and being driven away, and that's where the film ends. Now, the film footage in question is alleged to be part of that film footage, but what you see is a light off in a distance, a silvery light, coming closer and closer. But before you can get to see and make out what it is, it goes to a cut. Now it's an aircraft coming in for a landing.
Right.
Now,
and
the
film
footage, to, until it goes to the cut, the allegations is that is an actually the craft coming in. All I can say, and I got to be very careful because I've made some statements before about certain films and the media was, I'm acknowledging it's real. Well, I can't do that because I don't have that knowledge. But I can say that the film is haunting in that when you're waiting for one to come in to land and it's coming in with the aerial dynamics as we understand it and you see it off in the distance, in many instances it would appear just like that.
Yeah, I think that
close enough where you could make out the shape of the craft.
The footage is pretty interesting, I think. And for people listening, you can actually go to YouTube and look up Disney UFO footage, and you can see this small clip. And we're talking about it. It's, you know, it's dated. It's stuff that was filmed. I don't know when this might have been filmed, but it is film, and it's back possibly 60s or 70s. And you
it
see the mountains
in
the background.
It was 1960. I had a 400-foot roll of the film, Super 8. And I can tell you that if you had compare them side by side, it would look like that's exactly what you were seeing. The date of that film was April the 25th, I believe, 64. I can tell you that it was 1964 vehicles because it was a Ford, 1964 Ford staff car that picked up the individual
Oh, so you've seen the real footage.
I, at one time, had 400 foot of it.
Wow. And during this period of time, was that when you were with the unit?
No. It was when I worked about 20 hours and came home, and somebody called me from Florida, and we were talking about it, and being dead for sleep, I went ahead and acknowledged I had the film, and let's just say I didn't have it after that.
Wow. I bet you... And Eminger, I believe there
That's
is somebody who... Yeah, who says they saw that footage. They were shown the footage.
And I believe him.
Mm-hmm. And he came, I know he came to a MUFON and talked about it.
I'm going to tell you why I believe him. In 1977, there was underway, by the end of the year, to release a fair amount of the information and to acknowledge that, one, they mean us no harm, that their sole purpose for being here is scientific, but due to military reasons, they could not go into that as to what the scientific reasons was. Later on, that information would be coming out. But we had really nothing to fear from them. They were encouraging people, should you have contact, best thing to do, just stay away unless they initiate contact. If they initiate contact, don't be afraid that there's no harm going to come to you. Now, there are cases where that hasn't been the case, but in those cases, we were told not all contact would be of a friendly nature. Now, that being said, I believe they have rogue elements, not whole civilizations, because you have to grow spiritually with your technology. Otherwise, you will cease to exist as a civilization. We here on Earth, we either have to learn to grow spiritually. I'm not talking religion here. I'm talking about the spirituality of mankind. We have to really get to the point where we really care what happens to others, not just ourselves. We can't be self-centered. When we start doing that, I think our technology will start to pick up a whole lot more. But like right now, good example, look at road rage. Road rage never occur. It does. People get angry because they get cut off, or people get angry because somebody waits at a stop sign too long. We had a woman and child shot and killed because the woman cut this guy off at a stop sign.
Yeah.
He had a gun, he followed her and shot her, then shot her child also. That's not spiritual growth.
There are people who, I know at Laughlin was Ed Grimsley, and a lot of people talk about the and I have been hearing from a lot of people who are using night vision technology and seeing UFOs up there. And from one of these witnesses I heard recently, he said he saw a little battle scene happen where one of them crashed and burned up in the atmosphere. And Grimsley claims there are these massive battles going on that we can see with night vision goggles at night if we look. Do you know, have any knowledge of any battles going on like that?
I have no knowledge of full-scale battles like that, but yeah, I would say some of these rogue elements do make their appearance here on this planet. But here again, they're enemies of the very civilizations that are coming here.
Yep.
See, they're not a civilization per se. They just have their own agenda. There's that free agency out there. It's just like here in America, we have crime. But as a nation, we are against crime. But that doesn't stop some Americans from committing crime, very heinous crimes at times. Within their own civilization, they have the same thing. It's hard for us to comprehend, but that's really what's going on there.
And just to end with, because we just have a couple minutes, how many civilizations were you aware of, or was your unit aware of?
They had a book, and when I got out of the military, at that time they had cataloged 57 different species.
Mm-hmm. And how many did you interact with?
I would say probably 5 to 7 of the species.
And it sounds like you were recruited to communicate with one species in particular.
There was one species that I had close contact with.
Mm-hmm. And what was the nature?
The nature of that started when I was a child.
Mm. What was the appearance? What did they look like?
Well, this one was roughly 5 foot tall, very similar in appearance to your typical grays, only keeping in mind 5 foot tall. Greenish tint to the skin, and were the eyes that most people have of the huge black eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you could visualize like a water drop, the point of the water drop at the top was more toward the nose than out.
Mm.
That was the big difference. The larger part was out towards the side of the head.
Gotcha.
But also, with this particular entity, you could pick up on facial features. I mean, there was a personality there.
Mm-hmm. So facial expressions.
Yes. But
gotcha.
The one thing people need to keep in mind, you don't select to be contacted. They select you.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts at a very early age. But whatever is going on there, they're with you till they mourn your death. When you die, they mourn your passing.
It's interesting because I've heard of an abductee speaking about when her mother passed, she felt there were a bunch of entities there who were sad and mourning with her. And I thought that's always kind of carried that with me in my memories. So I've got about 5 million more questions and about 10, 12 more hours worth of talking I'd like to do with you. Luckily, I'm going to be able to see you in Roswell. If you could come and want to see Clifford Stone speaking in Roswell at the festival, which is July 2nd to the 5th, over the July 4th weekend, you can come out there and see him. If you look at the Roswell City website, you can see more information. But thank you very much for being on the show. I hope you'll come back again because, of course, your childhood experiences would be interesting to talk about. Also, some of the other experiences and what you've been doing since you've been out with your Freedom of Information Act requests. I think people would love to hear about that as well.
I'm a phone call away, sir.
Yep, which is wonderful. So I'll be talking to you some more. I can't wait to meet you and discuss with you face-to-face some of this stuff. But just to meet you and to see you face-to-face, it's going to be wonderful. But thank you for being on the show again. Next week will probably be a break for the show because busy. Got a cattle mutilation to investigate this weekend. Next weekend I have kind of a ghost phenomena, almost a mini Skinwalker Ranch type of situation. Going to go investigate the next weekend after that. But the 28th will probably be back. But check out the website. Thank you, everyone, for joining. Thank you, Cliff. I hope everybody has a wonderful weekend. And all right, we got Friday tomorrow, one of the great days of the week because we know our busy work week is almost over. All right. Well, thank you very much, Cliff.
Well, thank you, sir. And to you and your listeners, God bless.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.